Genesis contains some of the most familiar stories we know. One of the most intriguing to me is the Tower of Babel. It's become a part of our culture. If we say somebody is babbling, everybody knows what we mean. This morning, I want to take a close look at the original story, which is found in the 11th chapter of Genesis. When it comes to biblical stories, I always say context is everything. None of these stories exist in a vacuum. And unless we understand how they fit into the big picture, it's unlikely we'll really be able to understand what they're all about. The story of the Tower of Babel is placed immediately after the story of the Great Flood and Noah's Ark. We learn that many nations descend from the sons of Noah, and according to today's story, some of those descendants wander into Babylon. Soon after the Tower of Babel story, God calls Abraham to become the father of the nation of Israel. So this story is sandwiched between the story of God's destruction of almost the entire human race for its unredeemable evil and the establishment of the nation of Israel, the beginning of the Hebrew people. This placement is important because the Tower of Babel story deals with people who would one day become the enemies of Israel. At the time the story was written, they had become Israel's fiercest enemy. So we wouldn't expect the Hebrew author to treat these people too kindly, and he doesn't. According to the story, the descendants of Noah wander into southern Iraq, which was then called Babylon, where they learn how to make bricks. And while we can call into question the historic truth of the flood story, it's undeniable that the people who inhabited that area were excellent brickmakers. They built glorious towers to the Babylonian gods. Some of these towers were over 200 feet tall, which was an amazing accomplishment in the ancient Middle Eastern world. The Tower of Babel story is, in part, an attack on the people who built those towers. And it was written by the biblical author scholars call J, the letter J. Now is not the time to go into any sort of depth about the way the Old Testament was put together, but you should know that most scholars believe the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, was written by four different people. Somebody took the writings of those four authors and wove them all together, patched them together into the five biblical books we call the Torah. The most ancient of these four writers is called J by Bible scholars, which stands for the Yahwist, because this writer can be identified because of the way he refers to God as Yahweh. Well, I think this is interesting stuff. I don't want to get bogged down on it this morning, other than to say J had a relatively primitive view of God. For example, when you are reading through Genesis, you can usually pick out J's writings rather easily because his God has lots of human characteristics. If you read a story where God is walking along a path and talking to Abraham, for example, that's J who is writing. J's God often has legs. J says something interesting about God in the Tower of Babel story. He has God say, "Let us go down and confuse their language." Us. Who is Yahweh talking to? The story was probably written about 3,000 years ago in the 10th century BC, and the idea of true monotheism had not entered the human imagination at that point. Yahweh was the greatest God, but not necessarily the only God. If you'll think back to the creation story, God says, "Let us make man in our image." The implication, certainly, is that there is more than one God, or at least there are other celestial beings, perhaps not on a par with Yahweh, but just a step below. So this is a very old story, but it's also an ingenious story because it operates on three fronts. It is an attack on Israel's enemy, Babylon. It is an etiology, which I'll explain in a moment. And it is an important reflection about the relationship between God and humanity. First, the story serves as an attack on Babylon. The Hebrew word Babel or Babel means Babylon. It's also a clever play on words because the Hebrew word Balel, which looks and sounds like Babel, means confusion. The writer is hinting that all of Babylon is confused about the meaning of life and the purpose of civilization. The great tower built by the Babylonians were the pride and joy of the Babylonian people. These towers were not only great architectural feats, they were mighty monuments to the Babylonian gods. But look at how Jay, the Hebrew writer of this story, attempts to make such towers seem petty and irrelevant. The Lord came down to see the city and tower which mortals had built. Here we find that primitive God characteristic of Jay, since Yahweh has to travel, descend, to see the tower. But what a great image the writer creates. Here is the greatest achievement of the Babylonian people, and the Hebrew God practically has to stoop over and squint to even see what it is. The author of the story is basically looking at the greatest achievement of the Babylonian culture and saying, big deal. Along with being a verbal attack against Babylon, maybe the most interesting aspect of this story is that it's an etiology. Strictly speaking, etiology is a study of causes. In relation to the Bible, an etiology is a story that is made up, is written to explain how things got like they are. And the Bible has lots of them. Why do people die? We've got a story that explains that. A serpent convinced Adam and Eve to sin against God, and we are suffering the punishment for their rebellion. That's why people die. Just in chapters 2 and 3 of Genesis, we have etiologies that explain why women have pain in childbirth, why people have to work for a living, why we wear clothes, why the sexes are different. And we're free to believe that these stories are historically accurate accounts of things that actually happened, but most Bible scholars would insist that these are etiological stories written to explain how things got like they are. Etiological stories answer questions. And one of the questions that undoubtedly plagued the ancient world was, why are there so many different languages? Why do people from different parts of the world have so much trouble communicating with each other? Well, we've got a story. Once upon a time, everybody spoke the same language, the exact same language, but they angered God with their pride and their arrogance. And so God confounded their language and scattered them across the earth, so they would be unable to join together and work against God's purposes. You can see that the author of this story was no slouch when it came to writing stories. I mean, he was able to create a myth that explains the variance in languages in the world and at the same time take a good strong poke at one of Israel's enemies. But in addition to that, it's the third front that makes this story stand the test of time. This simple little story holds some important implications regarding the relationship between God and humanity that are just as true today as when they were written 3,000 years ago. Even though Jay was the earliest and in some ways the most primitive of the four authors of the Torah, he was a brilliant writer. Old Testament author Richard Elliot Friedman wrote a book in 1998 called The Hidden Book in the Bible. In that book, Friedman attempts to pull out all the J material from the Bible, and he puts it together in one long story. Friedman claims that the J account is the first true masterpiece of prose in all of human history. Let's consider the Tower of Babel story. To get really philosophical and theological for just a moment, it is at its core a story of human rebellion against the limits and distinctions between the human and divine worlds. The people in this story attempt to build a tower with its top in heaven. What would that mean to do such a thing? Remember the story of the Garden of Eden? That story claims there was a time and place where heaven and earth met in the heavenly Garden of Eden. And God removed Adam and Eve from the garden. Why? Because they had become disobedient. They ate the forbidden fruit. And God knew that if they disobeyed again and ate from the tree of life, they would live forever. they would themselves become gods. So they were ordered out permanently. Now that's just a story. Another story that deals with the relationship between humanity and God. But it relates to the Tower of Babel story. Consider the implications of human beings building a tower that reaches to heaven. Humans would overcome death. Human beings, by their own power and using their own abilities, would literally scale the walls of the eternal abode of God and say, "We're coming in, and you have no say in the matter." One of the foundational elements of the Christian faith, and especially important to our 16th century Protestant reformers, is that a human being cannot earn his or her salvation. The relationship between God and any person is at all times in the hands of God. Now, I have to mention that I often find myself wishing we would believe we could earn our salvation, because that would mean people would try harder to be decent and loving. I know from our discussions in the adult Sunday school class that one of the most common problems people have with many Christians is the way that some people think they can get away with anything. Thanks to Jesus, they got the God base covered. I've seen my share of this attitude. Hey, God loves me. It's God's nature. God will forgive my sins. It's just the way God is. So look out, world, because I've got some big plans and a God who will forgive me for all the people I use, abuse, hurt, and manipulate along the way. But that's a terrible misinterpretation of our faith. The idea that our ultimate salvation is in God's hands is supposed to be a comfort, not a license to turn our backs on love. This story tells us that eternity is in the hands of God, and as time-bound creatures, we can never scale the wall between this world and heaven. Beyond the philosophical elements of the story, consider what it says about our achievements and our culture in the eyes of God. Remember, the great towers built by the Babylonians were remarkable accomplishments, but they were nothing to God. Those bricks in which the descendants of Noah placed so much pride have turned back to dust by now. And in the eyes of God, they were no more than dust at the time they were used to build those great towers. They didn't matter to God. They didn't matter to God. And what did they lead to? What was the result of humankind putting forth its best effort in what it thought was a worthy cause? Alienation, dispersal, and a lack of communication. I think this is a great story, and it still speaks to the world we live in today. The present age can be called the age of technology or the age of communication. I don't know about you, but I find a fair share of contemporary technology confusing. And a significant portion of the communications I receive are meaningless babble. Typically, attempts to sell me something to make my life much more convenient and efficient, something that will supposedly make my personal powers of communication grow geometrically. And the television is such a wonder of communication. We get something like 60 channels, and sometimes we can even find something worth watching. The History Channel tends to be Lee's favorite, and I switch between that and the news channels. Corinne has 6 or 7 channels that she skips through so quickly I don't even know what they are. But there's usually something on somebody wants to watch. Why, there are times when Lee is in one room watching a documentary on World War II, I'm in another room watching a football game, and Corinne is in her bedroom watching something else. The television has done wonders for communication around the Cox household. And I know you see my point, because the scenario is not unusual in the typical American home. We're so wired up to the rest of the world, we're in danger of forgetting how to communicate with each other. I like email, and I really enjoy corresponding with my friends over the internet, but there's nothing like looking into somebody's eyes or taking their hand and saying a few words directly into their ears. And as I look at the world we have created for ourselves here on the leading edge of the 21st century, I see a world with an awful lot of babble. We are caught in the middle of a communication frenzy. But as more and more noise attacks our eardrums, it seems to me we're hearing less and less. And worst of all, the talk has gotten mean. I'm not sure what happened to us over the past few decades, but slowly and surely the general tenor of the public discussion has taken on a nasty edge. No place is this more evident than on talk radio, a medium I ignore as much as possible, but which I occasionally tune in just to see if the mood has changed. So far, it hasn't. Talk radio is just plain nasty, and the rhetoric keeps getting worse and worse. And my great fear is that we're getting so used to it, we don't even notice how bad it is anymore. I remember back in the early 90s how offended I was when Rush Limbaugh gave his weekly report on the number of homeless who had been killed in New York City over the previous week. He played every week this silly song called "Ain't Got No Home" in the background, while he laughingly talked about homeless people getting crushed in trash trucks. As they tried to escape the cold winters by sleeping in dumpsters, they were sometimes crushed when they failed to wake up as the trash trucks emptied the dumpsters and compressed the garbage. I never understood why Rush thought this was such a laugh riot. And then I remember watching his first television broadcast. I was curious what he looked like, and he was showing pictures of the Clintons as they moved into the White House. I saw this. He held up a picture of the Clintons' cat, Socks, and said, "This is the new White House cat." And then he held up a picture of young Chelsea Clinton, who was 12 or 13 years old at the time, and said, "And here's a picture of the new White House dog." That's when I knew the rules were changing, and our senseless babble was getting horrifically mean. We see echoes of this petty meanness as the press drags the current president's daughters through the mud, all for having the audacity as college students to drink a beer. That's just not front page news. I experienced the pinnacle of broadcast hatred in the mid-90s when I was traveling from Amarillo to Oklahoma City, skimming the radio dial, and for the first time stumbled across the G. Gordon Liddy Show. On that show, he was talking about what to do if government agents, particularly the ATF, alcohol, tobacco, and firearm agents, came to your door. He said not to make the mistake of shooting them in the chest because they wore bulletproof vests. And don't shoot them in the arm, he warned, because they will heal and one day return. No, you must shoot them either in the head or in the kneecaps. The headshot would kill them, and if you didn't have the nerve to kill them, taking out their kneecaps would assure they could never serve the U.S. government again. I couldn't believe what I was hearing on the radio. But I was not as surprised as most when, less than a week later, the Alfred Murrah Building in Oklahoma City was blown to pieces by a hate-filled anti-government zealot named Timothy McVeigh. Lee and I had friends in that building, and I hold the people who spew out their venomous anti-government hatred over the airwaves almost as responsible for the deaths of those innocent people as I do the man who lit the fuse, because those broadcasting hate mongers are the ones who helped light his fuse. Now everybody's babble seems to have gotten mean. People call Dr. Laura for advice, and she treats those callers like empty-headed simpletons, and they seem to love the abuse. I listen to sports radio, and the most popular show is Jim Rome's, in which callers get on the air only if they have a list of put-down slams of various athletes and sports franchises. We're communicating, but it sure seems like the vast majority of our communication is vacillating between meaningless babble and hateful harangues. I wonder if a big part of the problem is that we're on the verge of losing the most important form of communication of all, communication with God. And that communication won't come with the building of great towers, nor the development of ever faster forms of electronic media. It will come only when we slow down, and I mean slow way down, put down our tools, turn off the radio, turn off the television, turn off the computer, gather gently in the presence of our loved ones, and remember the quiet words of our Creator echoed in the voice of the psalmist, "Be still and know that I am God." Amen.